The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. A pretty little girl. An early memory, I'm six and clutching my mom's leg while strangers smile down at me, touch my curls, and say, "You have a beautiful child." My best friend at the time was John. I registered even then that when adults acknowledged him, they didn't simply pat him on the head and remark about how cute he was, the way they did with me and the other girls I knew. Instead, they engaged him in conversation, asking about soccer or how he liked school. And he wasn't shy in his answers, proudly announcing that he'd scored the winning goal or gotten an A on his spelling test. Adults seemed to want to know John. With me, they didn't venture beneath the surface. I learned to settle for that, to smile complacently when complimented and say thank you without offering more. Allowing myself to be defined by my appearance turned out not to be the wisest choice, as what inevitably follows childhood is adolescence. In other words, awkwardness, acne, and angst. At 10 years old, I entered an ugly duckling phase, and with the departure of my flawless skin and cherubic smile went my identity and self-worth. People stopped telling me I was pretty, and I stopped feeling that I was. If I wasn't that, I asked myself, what was I? Whereas before I had been at least noticed, now I was neither seen nor heard. I met that invisibility by disappearing further, dropping out of the world and into bulimia for 15 agonizing silent years. Then in my mid-20s, I found writing. It helped me grapple with all the issues that had plagued me since childhood and, along with therapy, enabled me to find my voice. Writing is a miraculous outlet for a woman because the work gets judged, not the person. I began to develop a following and felt a sense of confidence I'd never had before. People who read my words could see only my thoughts, feelings, and ideas. When I wrote, first my blog and then a book, I felt like I was beating the system. I could be heard and not seen. If I wrote with unwashed hair while wearing smelly sweatpants, it didn't matter. All that did was what I was typing, or so I thought. Over time, my career gained momentum, and I started doing a lot of public speaking and media interviews. Photos of me appeared online and in print when I published my first book. I began to detect a shift in the response to my work. There had always been some who got me and others who didn't, but the more well-known I became, the more personal, even vicious, the negative feedback got, and a lot of it was directed not at what I was saying, but at how I looked. I took those attacks especially to heart and tried to stop them by Barbieing myself up. I straightened my hair and dyed it lighter. I worked out obsessively. I became more conscious of what I wore. I whitened my teeth and got Botox, but that didn't stop the haters from hating. I looked old for my age. I was way too skinny. It didn't look good on me. I was wearing pants that were too tight or makeup that was too much. Shouldn't a woman nearing 40 cut her long hair? And what about that tan? Always the theme remained, Glennon, who do you think you are? And what makes you think you have the right to speak up? And if you do speak up, we will be there to remind you you're not good enough. I am in excellent company when it comes to outspoken women who are called out in ways that would be inconceivable for men in equal positions. More and more, it's in the air, let's face it. For the most part, men in the public eye are judged on the basis of their ideas, while women must first contend with whether we've earned a place at the table. Of course, whether we're worthy of that seat is often tied to our appearance. If we look too good, it's probably why we got there. And if we aren't beauty queens, we don't deserve to be there in the first place. In other words, the system is rigged. Because when it comes right down to it, it's not about whether we're the spitting image of Charlize Theron, but about power and making it even harder for women to gain some. The real goal is to shame us into shushing up, undermining our words before we even open our mouth. Once I really began to understand that, my inner warrior shouted, "Fight back!" We're playing a game in which the other side is holding most of the cards, so what do we do? The obvious choice would be to play along like a good girl. Definitely not the right strategy for me. Option 2, quit playing altogether. But I'm not a quitter. So that led me to one last alternative, create my own rule book. For one, it's useful to occasionally remind myself that I'm a writer, not a runway model. This means that criticism or praise of my appearance is irrelevant. I no longer concern myself with such comments. Do you know how liberating that is? It's downright revolutionary for a woman to decide once and for all that her looks don't have any bearing on her right to do her job or be measured by how well she does it. In this, we must be an outspoken sisterhood. What's the Holy Grail? To change social mores so that sizing up women based on their looks begins to be seen as a relic of an ancient civilization. Don't get sidetracked from the important work you're doing by letting look shamers psych you out. You're too beautiful for that. Our next article by Stephanie Farrington is titled, Can Gossiping Ever Be Beneficial? Two experts weigh in. A colleague I once worked with got on my nerves on a regular basis. I felt so triggered and affronted by her that I started to feel awkward interacting with her because it became harder and harder for me to hide my disdain. Why did she provoke such hostility in me? I turned to a mutual colleague to make sense of it. After parsing through the threads of my contempt, I realized that I found her too judgmental. Yes, here I was judging the judgy. And yet, despite how much it helped me pinpoint the source of my adjective, I felt unkind and inappropriate offloading ugly thoughts about her with our mutual colleague because we're taught that gossiping is a waste of words and a pernicious form of troublemaking. The wisdom of the wise says that if you can't say anything nice, say nothing at all. Gossip not only makes the gossiper look bad, but often needlessly and falsely damages the reputation of others. Netflix subscribes to this point of view so staunchly that the company fired three executives last spring who complained about upper management over Slack, naively thinking it was a private channel of communication, because doing so went against the company's ethos, which espouses radical transparency. On the company's website, it reads, "You only say things about colleagues that you are willing to share with them." But there's a problem with this black and white approach to gossip. According to Jennifer Bosson, PhD, a professor and associate chair in the Department of Psychology at the University of South Florida, people often gossip to gain clarity on how they feel about things. The ability to communicate with trusted others about negative feelings toward absent third parties is so fundamental to how we make sense of the world, she says, adding, it helps people figure out what they do and don't like. It's how we figure out about our values. Why did it bother me so much when so-and-so did that? Maybe that means I'm this kind of person. Bosson thinks Netflix's policy makes an impossible demand on employees, one that individuals will never fully heed. If they understand they can't complain over Slack, granted, not the smartest venue for taking umbrage with higher-ups, they'll do it at their local bar or at a coworker's barbecue. It's human nature, according to Bosson. Bosson, who's authored a handful of studies on the gossip, says her work shows that gossiping, especially about a shared dislike, improves social bonding. My research shows that it helps you become closer to another person to gossip with them. It communicates to them that you trust them because you're making yourself vulnerable by violating a social rule. A social rule that says expressing a negative attitude towards someone is taboo, especially in the workplace. Her colleague in the field of gossip studies, Eshin Jolly, PhD, a postdoctoral student at Dartmouth College in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences, has found similar results in his research. He notes that gossip is also a form of communication in which one is trying to resolve uncertainty about the social world. You don't know something, and maybe somebody else does. They can benefit from your knowledge. And likewise, you're willing to share something, maybe to help somebody else out. The happy outcome of being a reliable source of information vis-a-vis someone who has a shared point of view is that it tends to build a stronger relationship, so we end up becoming more connected in the process. Jolly and Bosson identify three ways to ensure you are gossiping constructively as opposed to destructively. Seek self-knowledge. Gossiping serves a functional purpose, even if it's negative, if you're trying to make sense of something about your own psyche or the world around you. We're talking about the kind of gossip where you're sharing your reactions, your feelings about what somebody else did or said or how they treated you, how they behaved, which is fundamental to our ability to be a social species. If we didn't engage in this kind of gossip, we would probably be much less cooperative as a species, she says. Make sure your claims are fact-based. It's critical, in Jolly's view, that the information you're imparting is substantiated by evidence. One thing we can do is ask ourselves, are we putting something into the social world that's going to create more uncertainty, more distrust, or is it substantiated? Using gossip as a tool to help each other out, rather than sow more distrust and chaos, is a more effective way to use it, he says. Keep the positive purpose front and center at all times. As long as there's some human social goal we're working toward, Boston says, gossip is functioning at an optimal level. What are we trying to work out individually and collectively? Is this conversation helping or hurting? If it's doing the latter, better to keep it zipped. If someone goes off the rails and starts delving into salacious or spurious content, Boston suggests disengaging from the conversation. She, for one, usually wanders away to pet a dog when discussions take a creepy turn, or more boldly calling it out. I'm not comfortable with this conversation. The point is to gossip in a way that productively serves you and those around you. Our next article by Vivian Manning Schaffel is titled, "The Time I Was Seen, Really Seen, by a Stranger." Earlier this year, my teenage daughter was having stomach pains. My husband and I took her to the ER to make sure she didn't have a ruptured appendix, and a CT scan revealed a 6-centimeter cancerous tumor. There is nothing more terrifying or soul-searing than learning your kid is this kind of sick. But instead of allowing it to actually dawn on me, I veered straight into triage mode. With the complex logistics of arranging pre-op testing, a complete nephrectomy, kidney removal, school absences, a dog sitter, and everything else involved in decamping our entire family to the cancer hospital back in the city we'd moved from the year prior, I had no time to wrap my mind around, let alone face, the magnitude of her diagnosis. We moved into a Ronald McDonald House, and my husband, son, and I took turns sleeping next to her during her scary, difficult recovery. I'd never, and hope to never again, seen her so sick. I would have done anything to ease her suffering, but no amount of reassurance, affection, or flower bouquets could ease her physical pain. All I could do was be there to bear witness and advocate. Meanwhile, my work colleagues were barely the wiser. As a freelancer, I couldn't afford time off, so I kept working. Luckily, I'm a writer and could interview celebrities from the Pediatric Intensive Care Unit, or PICU, while she slept. I found working somewhat therapeutic. It gave my brain someplace else to go and something to do where I could control the outcome. If I stopped moving for a single nanosecond, I would shatter into tiny shards. You can be the most private person on earth, but news travels fast when the C word is involved. As word about my daughter's health issues seeped out into the world, I got a lot of texts. Close and distant family members required updating. Close friends and parents of my kids' friends would check in to metaphorically prop us up, let me know they were in the neighborhood with a gift for my daughter, or take me for a lunch break. Even 5 minutes when I could step out of the hospital and see a loving face helped me feel less alone. As horrible as the ordeal was, at least we were back where we'd called home for 25 years, among people who really cared about us. Well-meaning acquaintances or former friends who'd long lost interest in me and my daughter also sent missives of concern. I fielded those messages as gracefully as I could, with thanks and prayers, hand emojis, grateful for each one. The glaring follow-up texts from those same people after the surgery made it clear those messages were more about fulfilling an obligatory chore of due diligence than a tangible offer of comfort and support, which just made me feel more alone. Once my daughter was released from the hospital, I had mixed feelings about going back to our new town, where the people seemed as emotionally distant from us and each other as their houses were far apart. After a short while, we went back to the hospital for follow-up tests. She was whisked off for scans, and my husband and I were left in a waiting room before a scheduled meeting with her oncologist to learn about her prognosis. Who knew if more insidious cells would find a way to invade another organ? How did a 15-year-old get a malignant tumor anyway? What would happen to her in 10, 15, 25 years? All the what-ifs were about to be for sures, as sure as anyone can ever be about cancer anyway. An hour passed. I was about to jump out of my skin. Sick of watching my leg bounce, my husband dispatched me for a walk, and I found myself in a thrift shop where all the proceeds benefit AIDS research. Mindlessly, I perused the racks and happened upon a beautiful black and white knit jersey, the tag still affixed, something my daughter was sure to love. I couldn't get in front of whatever news we were about to hear about her follow-up scans, but I sloppily reasoned the shirt might make her happy, even in the shallowest way. I get to the register and the cashier, a woman around my age with limpid blue eyes behind thick glasses, complimented my purchase before ringing me up. "Rag and bone," she said, celebrating my $200 top for $20 score. "This is really nice." "Thank you," I replied, rummaging through my wallet for a 20. "It's for my daughter," I said. "Oh, she's going to love it." A sigh leaked out of me. "I hope so," I said. "I want to make her smile." It might have been the first time in a few weeks someone engaged with me without a pall of pity or guilt hanging over our interaction. "She's having some tests right now." She asked where. The thrift shop was surrounded by hospitals, so I told her. Of course, this could only mean the C word. The cashier stopped ringing me up and looked me in the eye. She reached her hand across the counter for mine. "How old is she?" she asks. 14. "You must be so scared." It had been a while since anyone acknowledged my feelings about what happened to my child. "I'm terrified." I tried to dab away my tears, but it was no use. The floodgates to my eyes and my mouth were open. "We're so lucky. It looks good, but I'm terrified. I can't stop it." Her eyes started to pull up. "I understand that feeling," she said. "My son was in the hospital recently, and I was scared too." "I'm so sorry," I said, both of us leaking tears all over this thrift shop. "Does it look like he might be okay now?" "He was there for a different reason than yours, but I couldn't stop what put him there either, though I tried," she sighed heavily. "Lord knows I tried." Holy crap, I think. She really gets it. My mind raced. I wanted to ask her what her son's illness was, but I knew something about needing the details to remain private, even if you need intimacy about the feelings. She rooted around behind the counter for a bag to put the sweater in. "He's out now. I hope he'll be okay, but I don't have control over the choices he will make," her voice trailed off. "He's an adult now." It became clear she understood how it felt to helplessly watch your child suffer from something that put their life in danger. It was just a different something. "He has you and your love," I said. "He has the most important thing you can possibly give him." "I have hope," she said, "a lot of hope. And for a while, I almost lost it." It dawned on me that no matter what challenges our children were facing, hope was the one thing we had within our power to give them, and we were giving it to ourselves by giving it to each other. This perfect stranger and how she held space for me during her workday gave me hope there were people in the world who could support me in supporting my child without seeing it as an obligation or inconvenience. The woman slid the bag across the counter to me. "Please take this." "What? No," I said, waving the 20 at her. "You have enough to worry about right now," she said. A text buzzed in on my watch. It was my husband. My daughter's tests were done, and they were walking over to the oncologist's office. I had to leave. I wiped my tears and uttered, "I cannot thank you enough." I reached for her hand once more, hoping my words and the look on my face conveyed how much our conversation healed something in me that I didn't know was broken. "Go to your daughter," the woman said with a smile, squeezing my hand back one last time. The door to the thrift shop swung shut behind me, and I made haste to the hospital among a sea of strangers who could somehow find comfort in each other. All they had to do was talk. Our next article, by Lee Haber, Wadzani Moot, Hamilton Kane, and Carol V. Bell, is titled "Our Favorite Books of the Year." One of the pleasures of the holiday season is the pivot from past to future. As we take stock of the preceding 12 months and glimpse ahead to the coming year, just behind a shimmer of tinsel. Here, Oprah Daily serves up its list of 45 favorite books of 2022, spanning fiction genres, including romance and suspense, to nonfiction standouts and memoir, science, and biography, a cornucopia of rich reads to captivate bibliophiles. 2022's fiction enthralled us with daring techniques, wide-ranging themes, and gorgeous prose. Dip into Oprah Daily's 45 favorites and build your own reading list to savor as Father's on. Number 1, Afterlives by Adrilzak Gurna. Gurna, the recipient of the 2021 Nobel Prize in Literature and the first Black writer to win the award since Toni Morrison in 1993, centers the sweeping epic in Tanzania when the country is under brutal German rule in the early part of the 20th century. And while this is a novel spotlighting the devastation wrought by colonization, it is the intimacy with which Gurna renders his characters that makes it a heart-rendering and eye-opening standout. Number 2, All the Lovers in the Night by Miko Kawakami. From the celebrated author of Breasts and Eggs and Heaven comes her most accomplished novel yet. Kawakami's tale dissects the ennui of Fiyoko, a 30-ish copy editor and something of a social misfit. Face down on the mattress, I pulled the covers over my head and squeezed my eyes shut, she says, waiting for the things swirling in my throat to pass, the breath dampening my cheeks and eyelids infinitely hot and painful. Once Fiyoko resolves to transform herself, she sets into motion a chain of events that disturb the narrative in devious, electrifying ways. A contemporary Japanese master continues her meteoric rise into our literary firmament. Number 3, Black Cake by Charmaine Wilkerson. In many ways, Black Cake is a tale exploring what could drive a parent to risk so much for the sake of a dish eaten at celebrations and holidays. Set between an unnamed Caribbean island, based on Jamaica, the United Kingdom, and the United States, the novel is a migration narrative about the ways civilian and state violence push Black people to leave behind their kin and their countries in pursuit of safety. It is also a story of traditions forged through difficulty, of exiles holding onto the past as it slips through their fingers, and of new generations misunderstanding their inheritance. Brilliant. Number 4, Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver. The Appalachian Mountains are among the oldest on the planet, but their misty, mystical aura is timeless. Kingsolver's ravishing ninth novel brilliantly reimagines David Copperfield among the region's ridges and ravines and steely, poverty-stricken people. The novel's first lines echo Dickens's celebrated opening, but in a southern register. First, I got myself born. A decent crowd was on hand to watch, and they've always given me that much. The worst of the job was up to me, my mother being, let's just say, out of it. Kingsolver's hero captures our hearts and minds. His only weapons against the world are a handsome face and a savvy determination to prevail. She guides through the peaks and valleys of a saga whose empathy and gritty realism match the master's epic. Number 5, Dinosaurs by Lydia Millett. Nothing delights like a sublime novel cunningly crafted by a writer at the height of her powers. Gil is a wealthy, laconic white guy who, in the wake of a doomed romance, abandons his life in Manhattan for a castle in a normie Phoenix neighborhood. A picture-perfect family inhabits the glass house next door, gradually drawing him into the dramas of their lives. Millett's previous novel, A Children's Bible, was a finalist for the 2020 National Book Award. Here she metes out, in terse, calibrated prose, a tale of menace and redemption, and the wall that separates them like a clear pane. Number 6, French Braid by Anne Tyler. In her 24th book, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author observes the Garretts from their first and last family vacation in the 1950s through the present day, examining the challenges and joys of our daily intimacies with those closest to us. Some of the novel's dynamics and themes will at first seem familiar to Tyler aficionados, and we are passionate about her work. But subtly, gently, the iconic novelist nudges into new territory, pulling back from the quotidian and giving us an elegy to what falls away when our kids grow and we age and grapple with what remains and what will never be. Number 7, Homesickness by Colin Barrett. Many a writer claims mastery of technique, but few deliver at the level of Colin Barrett, whose roving perspectives, lopped-off endings, and Kevin Barry-esque dialogue dazzle in his second collection, mostly set in Ireland's County Mayo. Barrett harnesses his craft in service of his characters, mostly working and middle-class folks from Ireland's County Mayo. A shooting in Rathrodane mimics a police procedural as a world-weary policeman, think Nicola Walker in one of her indelible television roles, investigates a bizarre crime that isn't. In The Ten, a former soccer prodigy returns from Manchester to a dissolute life. The most boisterous piece, The Alps, features three brothers snagged in a weird incident at a pub. Barrett is a doyen of the sentence. Each snaps and sings like a bullwhip. We know these people because we hear and see them in perfect clarity. They're not homesick so much as sick of home. Number 8, Honey and Spice by Bolu Babalola. The holidays are the perfect time to sink into this sweet and savvy mashup. Like a Gen Z meeting of Nora Ephron and Bernadine Evaristo, in her first romance novel, the author of the myth-inspired story collection Love in Color infuses the joy, pain, and laughter of young love with cultural insight and drama. Kiki Olabanjo is a popular Nigerian-British college DJ spitting feminist wisdom against a hip-hop and R&B soundtrack for the black femme community at a predominantly white university. It's the perfect niche for the aspiring international media mogul until a new arrival shakes up her world. Newcomer Malachi Coreid is a fledgling filmmaker and Kiki's only competition for the bragging rights and privileges that come from being her department's star pupil. Though they spark instantly, Malachi's behavior leads Kiki to tag him a wasteman, i.e. a player. Only a forced career-making collaboration can break through the static of that bad first impression. This swoony coming-of-age tale cements Babalola's superlative status as a queen of romantic comedy and master chronicler of Black British life. Number 9, If I Survive You by Jonathan Escoffery. In linked stories, this radiant debut, long-listed for the National Book Award, charts one Jamaican family's fate before, during, and mostly after Andrew, a 1992 Category 5 hurricane that levels entire Miami neighborhoods. Escoffery offers a masterclass in technique, twirling gracefully among his characters' many conflicts and needs. Nevertheless, they persist, through demolished houses, painful divorces, and economic setbacks. In crystalline prose, Escoffery evokes the fluorescent textures of Miami, tapping Caribbean traditions, immigrant aspirations, and familial and communal bonds. Number 10, Killers of a Certain Age by Deanna Raiborn. In this unpredictable and propulsive romp of a thriller, after dedicating decades to eliminating the world's most dangerous offenders, four female professional killers on the precipice of retirement find themselves in their agency's crosshairs. Almost as maddening, no one can pinpoint the reason. In flashbacks, between thwarting their own assassinations and trying to ferret out why they've been targeted, we learn their stories. How this clandestine crew came into being, the challenges they faced, and how their spectacular success was finally turned against them. An inventive and distinctly feminist escapade. Number 11, Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmus. Darkly funny and poignant, Lessons in Chemistry paints an extraordinary portrait of an unusual life in 1960s California. As a young woman recognizing the hoop she must jump through as the lone female research scientist in an almost exclusively male-dominated world, the awkward and brilliant Elizabeth Zott is fiercely focused on her career. Dating is nowhere on the agenda. True love finds her anyway, and for a while it's glorious. Elizabeth and her colleague, Calvin, are the perfect nerdy pair, and their coming together is deeply romantic. Then life intervenes, and the story takes another surprising turn. The result is irresistible, a gorgeous tribute to resilience and the many types of love that sustain us. Number 12, Lucy by the Sea by Elizabeth Strout. Strout's stalwart, enigmatic heroine, Lucy Barton, is back in this gossamer novel set in the early days of the pandemic. As sirens wail across Manhattan, Barton, a writer, and William, her ex-husband and intimate friend, decamp to Maine, hoping to ride out the plague with a minimum of fuss. But as days turn to weeks, she grapples with an unprecedented emotional frailty reflected in the people around her. A triumph of astute observation and elegant simplicity by the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Olive Kitteridge. Number 13, Liberation Day by George Saunders. In his first collection of short fiction since 2013's 10th of December, one of our most inventive purveyors of the form returns with pitch-perfect, genre-bending stories that stare into the abyss of our national character. From brain-numb captives dramatizing Custer's last stand, to a vengeful writer, to a boy trapped in a hellish amusement park, Saunders' characters root around for redemption in the dark like stars or a trio of folks falling from a great height. An exquisite work from a writer whose reach is galactic. Number 14, Mr. B by Jennifer Homans. For fans of Homans' 2010 classic, Apollo's Angels, the magic is back. Here, she charts the life and times of arguably the 20th century's greatest choreographer, from his modest origins as Georgi Melitonovich Balakovods in late Tsarist Russia, to his flight from murderous Bolsheviks, to stints with Paris's Ballet Russes, to his triumphs as the legendary artistic director of the New York City Ballet. Homans brings to life the sweat and strut of studio classes, the jumps and jolts of business deals, and the hushed thrills of a Manhattan theater's dimmed footlights. Mr. B pirouettes and arabesques among a who's who of cultural Olympians. Sergei Diaghilev, Lincoln Kirstein, Salvador Dali, Maria Tallchief, and Fred Astaire, leavening her biography with sparkling anecdotes and trenchant analysis. Number 15, Night of the Living Res by Morgan Talty. A citizen of the Penobscot Nation, Talty plumbs the grit and grace of Rez life, mishaps born of dim hopes and brutal marginalization. His skegens are beset by drugs and booze and the force of their aspirations. Porcupine quills, card games, cans of beer, a beat-up iPhone. Talty deftly spins these details into totems of lives on the brink of ruin. There's no medicine to cure what ails them, and yet some break free from the vicious cycle. A blazing talent in the vein of Tommy Orange and Junot Diaz. Number 16, Night Crawling by Layla Motley. Motley began her astonishing debut novel when she was just 16. It has received raves from such luminaries as Dave Eggers, Kesey Lehman, and this one from James McBride. Layla Motley has an extraordinary gift. She writes with the humility and sparkle of a child, but with the skill and deft touch of a wizened, seasoned storyteller. Number 17, Nobody Gets Out Alive by Lee Newman. From the winner of a National Magazine Award comes an austere-winning atmospheric collection that broods on desperate lives amid Alaska's shiny flotsam of airplanes and speedboats and snow machines. Newman navigates the emotional fissures in her characters, a distraught woman willing to drive thousands of miles from an abusive marriage, a wife caught in an affair, her face a blur of panic. But the 49th state is the real star. From oil-rich Anchorage to the solace of wilderness, landscape is destiny. Number 18, Our Missing Hearts by Celeste Ng. Literary star Celeste Ng's third novel advances a once unthinkable proposition. Americans racked by insecurity embrace authoritarian solutions. In a time not far in the future, in the wake of economic and political meltdown, discrimination, censorship, and fear run rampant under the guise of peacekeeping. As challenging books are removed from shelves and dissidents are arrested from their families, a 12-year-old boy searches for his missing mother, an artist who might hold the key to a better future. With a chilling premise and frequently stunning prose, this dystopian drama is a jolt to the system and a booster of hope. Number 19, People Person by Candace Cardi Williams. The singular author of the best-selling Queenie, whose protagonist some dub the Black Bridget Jones, returns with a nuanced and endearing family saga featuring a hapless deadbeat dad. Cyril, he drives a shiny gold Jeep, and his five children with multiple baby mamas. One of his kids is the almost famous social media influencer Dimple Pennington, who, like her four half-siblings, has daddy issues that lead to a family crisis. Cardi Williams has said the idea for the book emerged from a conversation she had with her eldest half-sister about who would rescue her from trouble if push came to shove. From that chat, Dimple sprung. And when she accidentally kills her boyfriend, she must figure out who, among the family members she hasn't seen for 16 years, will come to her rescue. Fresh, funny, poignant, of the moment. Number 20, Sacrificio by Ernesto Mestre-Reed. During the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the 1980s and 90s, Cuba placed infected people in sanitariums, isolating them from the general population in a bid to prevent the disease from spreading. In Sacrificio, as in life, some deliberately injected themselves with HIV in order to receive regular meals and the relative comfort of institutionalization. Set in a time of upheaval after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Mestre-Reed's protagonist, Rafa, moves from a rural area in Cuba to the capital, where he waits tables at a cafe owned by his boyfriend Nicholas's mother. Through these characters and their desperation to move their country forward, we witness a complex Cuban history rife with political intrigue and plagued by the long shadow of poverty. Number 21, Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel. The lauded author of Station 11 and The Glass Hotel is back with a novel that, according to her editor, blends historical fiction, science fiction, and autofiction to capture the moment we are living through with devastating emotional precision. If Station 11, now an HBO Max series, anticipated the pandemic, her latest inhabits and expands on it through time travel and an author from a moon colony visiting planet Earth while on book tour. Number 22, Seven Empty Houses by Samantha Schweblin. Argentina's Master of the Macabre follows up her creepy, indelible Fever Dream and Little Eyes with a series of thematically linked pieces translated by the gifted Megan McDowell and just longlisted for the National Book Award in Translated Literature. Seven houses, seven stories, each haunted, literally or figuratively, from sorrowful ghosts to a frightened child to a disturbed woman stalked by who knows what. There's more than a bit of Twilight Zone here, as Schweblin deftly plumbs the frontier between fantasy and reality, how we project our vulnerabilities into the spaces around us. The walls were peeling. There was almost no furniture except for a table, three rickety chairs, and two armchairs covered in sheets that were transparent from use, knotted around the armrests so they wouldn't slip off. Number 23, Sweet, Soft, Plenty Rhythm by Laura Worrell. This sensual and sensuous debut is a kaleidoscope character study, a polyphonic riff on the modern-day Casanova from the perspectives of the myriad women in his wake. When charismatic jazz trumpet player Circus Palmer learns that his free-spirited lover Maggie is pregnant, his first instinct is denial. His second is to flee. "I already got a kid, barely talks to me," he tells her. He's not keen for another. The alternative, that he could do better by both, doesn't seem realistic. And yet, regret is the dread that stayed in his gut and grew solid. Both visceral and finely observed, the novel captures social nuance and emotional wreckage with precision and compassion. Number 24, Thank You, Mr. Nixon by Gish Jin. A Chinese girl in heaven writes a poison pen letter to a disgraced president in hell. A law school simmers with rivalries among immigrants. A painter pursues an obsession with the artist Mark Rothko. Welcome back to the singular world of Gish Jin's dazzling sardonic fiction. In our first collection in over 20 years, these linked stories probe the fractures in our divided country while grappling with the long tail of China's cultural revolution, skewering sacred cows, a triumph of humor and sorrow. Number 25, The Birdcatcher by Gail Jones. After Jones' 1975 debut novel, Corregidora, came out, Toni Morrison, Jones' editor, declared, "No novel about any black woman could ever be the same after this." Jones became a literary darling until disappearing from the scene for 21 years. She reemerged last year with the epic Palmares, a Pulitzer finalist, and this fall comes The Birdcatcher, a novel in which a gifted sculptor repeatedly tries to kill her husband as their friend looks on. Brilliant and incendiary, Jones' pairing of tragedy with dark humor cuts to the bone. Number 26, The Candy House by Jennifer Egan. In this inventive, effervescent novel, Egan, winner of the 2011 Pulitzer Prize for A Visit from the Goon Squad, asked the essential zeitgeist question, what's app? In 2010, Vix Bootin, a black tech visionary on the cusp of middle age, embarks on a mission to sate his omnivorous curiosity and enrich his family. He devises a download that accesses each person's archive of memories, opening the door to connections undreamt of by even Steve Jobs or Mark Zuckerberg. But not all's well in cyberspace. Egan plates multiple narratives and techniques to underscore the manifold ways our own desires betray us in a brave new coded world. Number 27, The Furrows by Namwali Sirpal. This much we know. On a Delaware beach vacation, 12-year-old Cassandra Williams, nicknamed C, is swimming with her adored younger brother Wayne when the 7-year-old boy flounders among the waves of an incoming tide. They manage to make it to shore where they collapse. When C awakens, there's a stranger looming over her and no trace of Wayne. From this primal tragedy, Sirpal, the author of the widely praised The Old Drift, spins a decades-long dream. The facts change, but the bewildering grief remains the same. She weaves influences from noir masters to canonical authors to visionary filmmakers, most conspicuously Alfred Hitchcock. The Furrows embeds allusions to the director's films, Strangers on a Train, The Birds, Vertigo, as C follows the trail of breadcrumbs to her fate. The novel's title references in part a line in Toni Morrison's Paradise, "Beware the furrow in his brow," which Sirpal has described as a contested and important sentence, alluding to a debate about God and our all-too-human frailties. Number 28, The Hero of This Book by Elizabeth McCracken. In what reads like a memoir of a woman's beloved mother, but is in fact a novel, McCracken's narrator visits London in large part as an ode to her late mom and to revive and commemorate her memories of their time together. Toggling back and forth between the present and past, the narrator processes her loss and her grief, recalling her mother's resilience in the face of a physical disability she barely acknowledged and never let slow her down. It's a joyful, wistful, funny tribute to a woman who may or may not, but probably was, inspired by the author's own parent, written with such loving detail that it is as if the reader is right there, part of the pair's tight family circle. Number 29, The Rabbit Hutch by Tess Gunty. The question The Rabbit Hutch attempts to answer is, what actually defines a life? As we come across medical marvels with phantom itches and mystics who miraculously survive death by lions, we also encounter the fragile break of a teenage heart and the furious grief of complicated mourning. There's the dark side to the internet, as the main character, Blandine, sees it, but also the refreshingly cordial comments on a post in a plant lovers group. No matter how you spin it, life, the mundane and the fantastical, is a kaleidoscope of juxtapositions. In a dark confession cubicle, a priest reassures, it would be absurd to describe a whole person as good or bad. You're just a series of messy, contradicting behaviors like everyone else. As long as you're alive, the jury's out. Number 30, The Passenger by Cormac McCarthy. The cosmic struggle between desires, erotic, aspirational, spiritual, and stone-cold reality arcs through McCarthy's lengthy, Nobel-worthy career. At 89, he's still riffing, like a jazz virtuoso, on the American Nightmare, Faulkner's myth-making, and the cadences of Joyce. McCarthy's flame burns bright and clear in two new works, his first since The Road, winner of the 2007 Pulitzer Prize and an Oprah Book Club selection. The Passenger, wondrous in its architecture, and a companion piece, Stella Maris, a minimalist edgy novella. He showcases a carnival of tormented souls, among them a Los Alamos scientist's grown children, Alicia Western, a suicidal mathematics prodigy, and her older brother Bobby, a former physicist turned salvage diver, as well as a vaudevillian cast of schizophrenic hallucinations, including the MC known as the Thalidomide Kid, potty mouthed with flippers instead of hands. McCarthy toggles between books and across decades, sketching the contours of a love that dare not say its name. McCarthy's art is transcendent, even as it takes no prisoners, an achievement akin only to the overs of his greatest peers, Toni Morrison and Philip Roth. He will endure. Number 31, The School for Good Mothers by Jessamine Chan. Frida Lou has finally found a job in Philly while also trying to share custody of her toddler, Harriet, with her estranged husband, Gust, when she makes a life-changing mistake. She leaves Harriet alone for hours to get in some work at the office. When the police find the unattended child, Kafkaesque events begin to unfold in this intense, unputdownable debut that will doubtless spark conversation about what makes a good or bad mother. Number 32, To Paradise by Hanya Yanagihara. In To Paradise, Yanagihara reimagines a divergent United States after the Civil War. In the aftermath, the country is divided into the North, Free States, the United Colonies, and the West. The Free States comprise a world in which same-sex marriages are the norm at the turn of the 20th century. As we read, the strangeness of this world confuses, but as the story develops, we accept and then forget as we immerse ourselves in the characters' lives. That Yanagihara turns our expectations and changes our perceptions is what makes To Paradise a masterpiece. Number 33, Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin. Stow away your iPhone and settle in with one of the year's most ingenious books, a genre-bending novel probing friendship, tech culture, and emerging art forms. As kids, Sam and Sadie bond over a shared passion for gaming and the compulsion to shake loose the confines of the physical. Over three tumultuous decades, they become best friends, then business partners, then rivals, forging a platonic relationship more intimate than lovers. Number 34, Trust by Hernan Diaz. Trust raises very topical questions about the value of narrative, particularly when American capital is at stake. In a world in which gargantuan personalities can maneuver who we believe and what we trust, the truth is almost inconsequential. The four competing narratives depict the rise and fall of a 1920s Wall Street luminary. The novel detonates in the third part through the perspective of a young novelist, daughter of an Italian anarchist. And undesirable by proxy, her clarity of purpose and willingness to examine her own complicity in creating alternative facts forces us to rethink how we trust and why we believe whatever we believe so complacently. Number 35, Winter Work by Dan Fesperman. This masterful historical thriller blends espionage, domestic drama, and murder. In 1989, the fall of the Berlin Wall marked the final coda to the Cold War and ushered in massive geopolitical and social change. In addition to shifting the borders of nations and the flow of people, it dismantled the state spy apparatus known as the Stasi. That put a treasure trove of sensitive secrets up for grabs, precipitating a mad scramble by potential state buyers, including the USA and the Soviet Union. Those events also impacted the daily lives of millions of people in far more intimate ways. This evocative murder mystery vividly captures what happened on the eastern side of the wall on a political level, including how the cache of secrets ultimately found its way to the CIA, and a personal one, from the perspective of an unusual protagonist, a sympathetic East German spy with a complicated and messy home life. Number 36, By Hands Now Known by Margaret A. Burnham. This meticulously researched history of how lynching shaped Jim Crow and reinforced racial hierarchy is the corrective we all need. Activist, defense attorney, judge, and now the director of Northeastern University's Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project, Margaret A. Burnham spent devoted years on the front lines, fighting in the proverbial trenches against injustice. This book is a rich, evocative testament to that life's work as she illuminates a series of harrowing, untold cases of racial violence from 1920 to 1960, tapping a database she built over the course of a decade. Her insights and interpretations bring a vital, necessary perspective to the segregationist era. Number 37, Constructing a Nervous System by Margot Jefferson. With gorgeous writing and indelible insight, the singular work defies categorization. Turning a sharp eye on her own life, the Pulitzer Prize-winning cultural critic and memoirist, Negroland, Margot Jefferson reflects on pivotal moments in her past and the art and artists who shaped her. With the express goal of fusing criticism with memoir, Jefferson dives into the murky depths of thought and feeling that evade or even refuse traditional storytelling. The result of this boundary crossing is what Jefferson dubs a temperamental autobiography. If not entirely unique, Hanif Abdurraqib's A Little Devil in America occupies a similar literary juncture. When genres merge this thoughtfully, it's a beautiful place to spend time in. Number 38, Finding Me by Viola Davis. In her powerful and empowering memoir, the first Black actor to earn the so-called Triple Crown of Acting, an Oscar, a Tony, and an Emmy, details her rise from poverty and other trauma to emerge as an iconic American artist. Through revisiting her childhood and all its pain, she was able to finally answer the question that had long haunted her: how did I claw my way out? About the Oprah Book Club pick, Oprah had this to say: there are so many lessons to be learned from this breathtaking memoir about triumphing over adversity and trauma. Viola Davis leaves it all on the page, from her beginnings in South Carolina as the fifth of six children born in a sharecropper's shack, to acclaim as an actor, producer, and philanthropist. I was so moved by this book that I just had to share it with our entire OBC audience. Number 39, An Immense World by Ed Yong. Throughout the dark days of our pandemic, readers have turned to The Atlantic's Ed Yong for his masterful reporting and trenchant analysis, which have netted a Pulitzer Prize and other accolades. His sublime new book, An Immense World, delves into animal senses and what they reveal about umwelt, the part of those surroundings that an animal can sense and experience, its perceptual world. From shrimp vision to sonar to mosquito taste buds, Yong's narrative brims with vivid scenes from laboratories and in the field, astute interviews with researchers across a spectrum of disciplines. Biology geeks will dine out on the rich anecdotes, the historical detours, and pithy footnotes, rendered in a witty, crystalline style. Number 40, Lady Justice by Dahlia Lithwick. In the wake of the 2016 presidential election, when many progressives were still nursing shell shock, a group of women attorneys took action. Weaving together legal analysis and interviews, Slate senior correspondent Dahlia Lithwick constructs an alternate history of the Trump years, focusing the people who worked to combat the devastating policies enacted during their term and their lasting legacy. That includes new legends like Sally Yates, the acting U.S. Attorney General who refused to sign off on the Muslim travel ban, and Georgia gubernatorial candidate and voting rights advocate Stacey Abrams, alongside a host of lesser-known yet wholly inspirational figures. As Lithwick underscores, the Supreme Court's life-altering Dobbs decision, which ended federal protection for abortion, only underscores the rousing urgency of these 21st century profiles and courage. Number 41, Lost and Found by Catherine Schultz. The meaning of losing a loved one and how one finds grace in the aftermath of loss is examined here with Schultz's attentive reporting and tender vulnerability. Writing about the impact of her father's death alongside finding the love of her life, a fellow writer, Lost and Found exemplifies the best of what memoir can do and how it can make us feel. Number 42, South to America by Imani Perry. The South has given America its dollar stores, the best of its cuisine and culture, and while most people don't give the South credit for this, leaders of the Black Power movement who were born and raised there. Perry, a daughter of the South and a Princeton professor, shows us dimensions of the South and its centrality to American identity that have previously gone underexamined. Number 43, The Grimkes by Carrie K. Greenridge. An eminent African-American historian skewers one of our most entrenched white savior myths. The Grimke sisters of South Carolina, whose pioneering work on abolition masked deep familial hypocrisies. An adroit storyteller, Greenidge mines archives and her expose of Sarah and Angelina Grimke, the erasure of their Black relatives, and the subtle yet resilient relations cobbled together in the shadows of slavery. They were particularly unwilling to take a stand against their colleagues' racial discrimination when the Black person in question did not fit the image of the kneeling slave with raised arms. Greenidge unearths a disquieting tale, inconvenient truths that strike at the shibboleths of race, gender, and power. Number 44, The Revolutionary by Stacey Schiff. From ivy halls of academia to gritty protests in city squares, the war over American history rages on. Welcome, then, a beautifully crafted and valuable biography from a Pulitzer Prize winner and best-selling author of The Witches. In Schiff's telling, Samuel Adams was the most quixotic of founders, a firebrand who sparked the powder keg of colonial disaffection, an early proponent of abolition, and a visionary whose swagger wore down both friend and foe. John Adams gave his cousin full credit as muse of the American Revolution, and Schiff digs deep here, vividly recreating pivotal scenes in the early history of the Republic, such as the Boston Massacre and the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Schiff ingeniously connects the past to our present and future, underscoring the lessons of Adams while reclaiming our nation's self-evident truths in a moment when we seem to have forgotten them. Number 45, The Song of the Cell by Siddhartha Mukherjee. The wonders of the cell, the microscopic thumbprints of life, have long enthralled and confounded us. As we've increasingly discerned the structures and functions of cells and their relationship to our genetic code, we've realized the more we know, the less we know. Mukherjee, an oncologist and author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Emperor of Maladies and The Gene, charts atlases of cells from those that combat diseases to essential neurons to the runaway trains of cancer. The Song of the Cell blends cutting-edge research, impeccable scholarship, intrepid reporting, and gorgeous prose into an encyclopedic study that reads like a literary page-turner. Realized, the more we know, the less we know. Mukherjee, an oncologist and author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Emperor of Maladies and The Gene, charts atlases of cells from those that combat diseases to essential neurons to the runaway trains of cancer. The Song of the Cell blends cutting-edge research, impeccable scholarship, intrepid reporting, and gorgeous prose into an encyclopedic study that reads like a literary page-turner. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.